time for Microbrew, Brewers Chatter from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. My name is J.R. Radcliffe, and on the other line is Todd Rosiak. He is the Brewers beat reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He is in Arizona. One more week, I believe, in Maryvale, where the Brewers are underway in spring training. The games have begun. They began last weekend. Saw some pretty positive results, actually, if you are listening to this on a Tuesday. Monday, they had a nice offensive outpouring. Saturday was a pretty good offensive showing, so we're going to talk about all of that stuff. Todd, I want to start, though, actually kind of back a few days, because since we last podcast, the Brewers have added a couple, two very interesting names to me, one being Luke Voit, a right-handed hitting first baseman, Tyler Naquin, who Brewers fans may remember from his time with the Cincinnati Reds, is another guy who could probably play a couple different positions, but I'm interested in those guys because I don't know outright where they necessarily fit on this roster, particularly Naquin, but there's a chance Luke Voit ends up making this 26-man roster out of camp, I think. There's at least a pathway for that. I'm curious if you think, I guess, what you would put their chances at making this roster. If you think that there's a pretty good chance or if they're a long shot, like where do you sort of classify those two guys?
I would say, in my opinion, Luke Voit's got a pretty decent chance of making the opening day roster. Tyler Naquin, I think, is going to be more dependent on where Tyrone Taylor's health is getting more toward opening day. We don't really know yet what the deal is, when he's going to be returned to action. He's been shut down for a little bit with that sprained elbow. So it's interesting that they just, you know, signed both guys on the same day last Tuesday. The Luke Voit signing on paper makes sense because that's a right-handed guy who can play first base. He's a proven guy who, not counting the pandemic. Well, actually, yeah, counting the pandemic here, he's had three seasons of 20 or more home runs and is a proven run producer. Problem is, he is just like Keston Hira in that his splits are reversed, so he hits right-handed pitching way better than left-handed pitching, and that doesn't really help when you've got Rowdy Tellez starting most days against right-handed pitching. So I think the Brewers still feel like Voit can be a factor over there at first base, and I think they're very pleased that they were able to get him at the, you know, at a bargain basement price, and really no harm, no foul by adding him on a minor league deal right now. See how he does, and you know, he kind of reconvened toward the end of spring training. The Naquin move makes sense in the short term in that he is a guy who is comfortable in right field. He is a left-handed hitting outfielder. So if he were to make the opening day roster, let's say Tyrone Taylor is a right-handed hitter, so you could put Tyrone Taylor in center field. You could put Naquin in right field. There's a bunch of different ways you could go. And he's also a guy who's had several really good years, and veteran guy, was on a good Mets team last year after the trade deadline when the Reds sent him over there. So a lot to like with both of those guys, but time will tell. We'll see. We're still very early in the spring. See how those guys will do. But if I had a handicap, I would say Luke Voit probably has a much better chance of starting the season with the Brewers than Naquin.
You mentioned a guy, Keston Hira, how Luke Voit is similar in that reverse split, or I should say reverse platoon splits, which I feel like is maybe something the Brewers sometimes seek out. It seems like they have a lot of guys that sort of at least loosely fit that profile. I think even Rowdy Tellez a little bit at one point in his career kind of fit that profile. But Keston Hira is a guy that I think about a lot because I just truly don't know what the future is with him. You know, they've seemed to have a lot of guys who can play multiple positions, who, you know, can do some things. They do need people who are capable of hitting left-handed pitching. But as we said, that wasn't necessarily Hira's strength. A guy who doesn't really have a clear-cut position, and seemingly they're bringing in people who are capable of doing some of the same things that he can do. And I just don't know what's next for him. I don't know if they have him start at AAA. If there is, actually, now that I say that, I don't even know if he has an option left. I believe he does, but I'm not positive.
And he does not.
He does not. Okay, so that even complicates it further. So they can't do that part without losing him. You know, like, you'd think if they would have been interested in trading him, that move would have been done a long time ago. I can't imagine he's just like a spring training afterthought, you know, right before you break camp. I can't imagine that's how they end up, how the Keston Hiura story ends in Milwaukee. I don't know, man. What do you have any insight into what comes next for Keston Hiura?
I really don't. It's he's in the mix with a whole bunch of other guys this camp, and to me, he is a guy that really needs a good camp to solidify his standing. And he is also a guy who, if for some reason doesn't have a good spring and the Brewers DFA him, I would that you know, some other team would snap him up in a heartbeat because of his prior track record and the fact that he's still young. So Brewers are kind of caught in a trick box there unless they decide they don't have room for him. And with other teams doing some last minute jockeying at the end of the spring and decide they really want him, then, you know, maybe you can work some kind of deal, one for one deal or something like that, or for a minor leaguer. Who knows? But it's going to be incumbent on Keston Hiura to really show the Brewers that he is worth keeping around. Having some success against left-handed pitching would be nice in the spring here, I would think too. Although I think the die has already been cast kind of on him. It is what it is. He hits righties better than lefties for whatever reason. So I also think he is what he is defensively. You know what you're going to get, which is not a very good defensive player, no matter where you put him at first base, second base, or left field. And it sounds like they're going to be playing him some more in left field this camp. So no easy answers with him. And I think one way or the other, we probably will have some sort of resolution as far as his Brewers career goes here in about 3.5 weeks.
Yeah, the one thing you could say is that you mentioned that Tyrone Taylor injury in passing. I don't think we've even talked about that, the fact that he's behind out the first couple weeks of spring training as he gets healthy. And quite honestly, the track record, at least anecdotally in my mind, when somebody misses the first couple weeks of spring training, they're brought along so slowly that you can't really expect that they're necessarily going to be healthy off the injured list to start the year. Now, who knows? He might be fine by opening day. There's still a long way to go, but it would be my suspicion that he winds up maybe on the injured list to start with. And this is a team that doesn't have a lot of outfielders. You know, I mentioned Naquin, but theoretically Keston Hiura could play in the outfield. And Jesse Winker is a guy who I think they'd rather have DH, like we talked about last week, but that might have to be somebody. Brian Anderson, Owen Miller is a guy in the mix. They have so many guys, and I don't know precisely where they fit or if they fit, but it is interesting how it's developed. One guy that I think I kidded about this on Twitter when Garrett Mitchell hit two home runs on the very first spring training game on Saturday. I said, okay, I've seen enough. He's your starting center fielder for opening day. I think if Taylor's hurt, he actually probably is your starting center fielder on opening day, whether or not he hit two home runs. But that's pretty encouraging to see. And you know, I don't know. You know, I think people who follow this organization, the prospects, a lot of people thought Sal Frelick was the better prospect overall and were surprised when Garrett Mitchell got the call last year. I was one of them. I happen to think that Sal Frelick looked like a guy who really could contribute right away, and they made what I thought was kind of surprising, the move to go with Mitchell, a guy who'd been in the organization a little bit longer. Joey Weimer has gotten some pretty good playing time here in the spring training games. He's a guy who's got a very exciting bat. But you know, you don't want to forget about Garrett Mitchell. That's a first round pick. It's a guy who can play center field and play it very well. And as he showed here in spring training, he's got a little pop. We know he's got a little speed. I mean, he is kind of an exciting player. And I don't know if he quite gets that prospect shine that others do, but I don't know. Give me your thoughts on what you've seen. Obviously, there's hardly anything that you've seen from Garrett Mitchell so far, but you know, he certainly hasn't, you know, he's certainly picking up where he left off last season.
I don't think he's kind of an exciting player. I think he has the potential to be a really exciting player.
Cool.
He is a guy who, if he can cut down the strikeouts, and that's something that he brought up right away when we talked to him Saturday after that two home run game, he can cut down on those strikeouts, get on base a little bit more consistently. He has power. We've seen that in flashes. I wouldn't necessarily call him a power hitter, but he has the ability to hit the ball out of the park. But just getting on, I mean, the guy is the master. I saw it in the minor leagues. He did it a few times in the major leagues last year when he got called up. Hit the ball on the ground, slow rollers. The guy beats him out. You know, he's one. I think I read that, you know, in terms of sprint speed, time to first base, he's in the top 8 or 10 in the major leagues in terms of just flat out speed. And with the new the new rules, the bigger bases. He could be really fun to watch running the bases and stealing. He could go from first to third very easily. He's a guy who I think can, you know, really push outfielders and, you know, maybe try to take an extra base here and there. Just he's a fun guy to watch, and he's still really young in his career. Ton of talent, ton of potential. So let's see. But again, it's all dependent on whether he can consistently make contact, cut down on those strikeouts, and really learn to put the ball in play more consistently, which you mentioned Sal Frelick. That is his calling card and his strength. Whenever he does get the call, and you would figure it would be sometime in the first few months, one way or the other.
On the pitching side, this is a time of year where you really get to see the depth of the organization to some degree. At least you do. Not so much the fans as much when only a slate of games are televised, not the whole thing. But you get to talk to guys like Robert Gasser, who you spoke to. I know you wrote about Ethan Small. Cam Robinson is a guy who I think is a little bit under the radar, but people who follow this organization know who he is and know that he's capable of contributing this year. Even though they may have even seen him pitching in Appleton with the Timber Rattlers. I'm interested if there's anybody that you've been drawn to in the early going on the young pitching side, somebody who's really jumped out. Unfortunately, Ethan Small had a rough first outing. I am keeping an eye on him to see if he could maybe contribute as a reliever this year. We know that's kind of his destiny going forward. And it was tough to see him struggle right out of the gate. These are one inning appearances. Of course, these are nothing, caveats galore, but you obviously want to see everybody get off to a good start if you can. Anybody jump out at you? I know you'd mentioned to me off mic that Robert Gasser's a pretty easy guy to talk to, and he's got a pretty interesting spotlight on him in this organization. What have you gleaned from your time talking to some of these players?
Yeah, it's still very early, so I haven't really seen a lot of any of these guys. But Gasser, interesting kid to talk to, very well spoken, very cerebral, and his spring debut on Sunday against the Rockies at Salt River Field was a real good one from what I heard. I was not there. It was only an inning, but a couple of strikeouts, gave up a hit, gave up a walk, but looked like he sat around 93, 94 with his fastball. Slider's a great pitch for him, of course. So that's a guy to keep an eye on this spring. And, Craig Counsell mentioned, I had that prominently in my story, that he absolutely is going to factor into the mix for the Brewers at the major league level at some point this season. Where and when remains to be seen, but that's high praise from the Brewers skipper for sure. And the other guy, just because he's fresh in my mind, just saw him a couple hours ago, is Abner Uribe. He made his spring debut against the Royals and was just 98, 99, 100 in his inning. Control obviously is going to always be a factor for him, or at least it has been to this point. Craig Counsell just mentioned that he's a guy who just needs to get out there and pitch regularly. He missed almost all last year with a knee injury. Did not have a lot of experience before that. But I think in best case scenario, he goes down wherever they send him, whether it be double A, triple A this year, and he's able to stay healthy, pitch a number of innings, show the Brewers that he can go, consecutive days, that he can bounce back with his arm. And also very importantly, like I mentioned before, dial in that command. And if he's able to do those things, that's another guy that no question would be in the mix at the major league level for the Brewers, because you just don't see arms like that all that often. And the Brewers certainly do not have anybody that throws that hard in the upper levels of the minors, or even on their major league team right now at this point. So another exciting guy to keep an eye on for sure.
Yeah, I know you also wrote about Lucas Ursig, who's a little bit of a curiosity as a guy who was a position player and it has worked his way back to at least shouting distance of a big league spot as a pitcher. And you talked about John Singleton, who is not a pitcher, but a hitter, a guy who was in the minor league system last year, former bonus baby who's kind of working his way back to the big leagues. And obviously a lot of interesting stories. You know, Robinson really, really is interesting. He didn't have a very good showing in a very limited amount at Triple A last year. He was pushed pretty quickly through the system last year. He pitched at Wisconsin, Biloxi, and Nashville, and like Uribe, ton of strikeouts. The walks are high also, you know, like that's always going to be a thing, I think, with a lot of these guys, is finding the control to match the strikeout potential. But I think we're going to hear his name at some point this year, Cam Robinson. I think he's going to slide into a spot on this roster at some point. I just have a feeling. How much have you even seen the veterans? I know that primarily it is the younger guys who are playing. Are you expecting over the course of the next couple of weeks we're going to see more from the guys like you know, the pitchers, Burns, Woodruff, Christian Yelich? I mean, are they on deck here sometime in the near future?
Yeah, they're all on deck for sure. Christian Yelich and Jesse Winker are both expected to start playing games this week. So I would guess for Yelich, probably Thursday this week would be, I don't have that on authority, it's just my guess, but Thursday would probably be a good guess for him. Perhaps Winker too, maybe more so the weekend for Winker. And Adrian Hauser pitched today against the Royals, his first inning. Got Devin Williams starting and pitching an inning on Wednesday at the Angels, and then Corbin Burns is making his spring debut Thursday at home. So these guys slowly but surely are getting in, you know, even though they haven't gotten, some of the guys still haven't gotten into games, like Brandon Woodruff, Wade Miley and so forth. They're doing their stuff in live batting practice and all that sort of thing. So everybody's getting their work in. There's really, you know, with the amount of arms that the Brewers have, they're able to use some of these guys in. And then things will take a little bit of a turn, and things will start to look different toward the end of the week when the WBC guys all start filing out and heading off to their various locations, wherever they're going to be. I talked to Sal Frelick. He's preparing himself mentally for a 16-hour plane ride from L.A. to Taiwan. So he, you know, said he's looking forward to that adventure. He's never traveled that far, certainly. And to be able to do that as part of Team Italy for the WBC is going to be an exciting thing for him. So, yeah, once those guys ship out, we'll start seeing different guys cycling in. We'll start seeing different lineups and, you know, maybe some more young guys. To me, that's the fun part of these games, not so much what the veterans are doing, but like we saw against the Royals here in the final innings. Today, Jefferson Carroll, Tyler Black, Edward Perez, Joe Gray Jr. was in the game, although he certainly didn't make the mark that those other three guys did. Abner Uribe pitching. And these are all guys that are within a few years are going to be wearing Brewer uniforms pretty regularly if all goes according to plan for the organization. And this is the future lifeblood of the franchise. So that to me is fun to see what those guys do. Eric Brown Jr., the 2022 first-round pick, yesterday hit a two-run homer at American Family Fields of Phoenix. So that's kind of been one of the cool storylines, is the young guys early on have been living up to the hype and turning heads.
One other guy I want to ask you specifically about, you wrote about at jsonline.com, and that's Abraham Toro. It's a guy that I haven't said his name a lot. You know, I don't know if he makes the team, but he was part of one of the more significant offseason maneuvers that this team made in the trade that also brought Jesse Winker in from the Mariners. And again, like going back to some of those names of guys like Owen Miller, you know, they've got a lot of guys who can be that utility man if there is room for something like that on the roster. You know, Keston Hira to some degree is kind of in that boat as well. I don't know where Abraham Toro fits. I mean, I haven't even mapped out lately where I think the opening day roster will look like, even allowing for a couple injuries, that will certainly be the case. But what, because he's an interesting guy. Give me some of the background of what you wrote about and sort of his background and where you see him fit on this team.
He just fits the prototypical mold. The guys that the Brewers like, multi-position player guy, also a switch hitter. He can play, his natural position is third base. I would say second base is his next position after that. He can play a little bit of first base. He can play the outfield in a pinch. He said he's even had a little bit, tiny little bit of experience at shortstop too. So again, a guy that just can do a little bit of everything across the board. You know, he's got some experience as well. He was on a good Astros team. He was on that Mariners team last year that made the playoffs for the first time since 2001. So he does have some experience in big games and pennant races and that sort of thing. And, you know, above and beyond all that, just a very interesting guy, a Venezuelan who was born in Canada, learned English at age 16. So he's trilingual, very, very well read, very interesting to talk to. He said he's trying to learn Italian as well. So just kind of a cool story beyond the playing field for sure. But he's going to have his work cut out for him this spring because, as you mentioned, there's a bunch of other guys on this roster that can kind of do many of the same things that he can in terms of playing around the diamond and, have experience under their belts, that sort of thing. You know, the Owen Millers of the world. You got Brasso, who already has a track record with the Brewers. You've got a young guy like Bryce Terang, who, even though I would say the odds are against him making the opening day roster, certainly will be in the mix moving forward. So it's going to be incumbent upon all those guys to get off to good starts and try to maintain that the best they can throughout the spring. I would say so far of that group, Owen Miller has probably been the most impressive to this point. He had two doubles on Sunday in the game against Colorado, and he had another one today while getting a start at first base against the Royals. So definitely one of those. It's not a singular positional battle, but one area of the roster that I would say is going to feature some of the most interesting battles among players to make that opening day roster.
Yeah, if I recall last year, Owen Miller started out guns a-blazing. He was awesome for the first part of the season, and he did fade over time, but maybe he's just the type of guy who can really, just really get going out of the gate. He still had an OPS well over one as of the start of May, and it was still in the 900s and 800s before it started to taper down by the end of that month. But, you know, he might be a guy that if you have an injury or something, he's the first guy you turn to, and you sort of just, you know, ride him as hot as he is and see where that goes. Last thought here is kind of related to what we talked about last week. We talked about some of the ways that this team is kind of in a weird place with things like the Corbin Burns arbitration situation, the fact that Craig Counsell's in his last year, that there's still some, I would say, for Brewers fans anyway, some residual holdover from the Hader trade and just coming into the year. I don't know what the term would be, just dubious. I don't know. Like, I still think the Brewers are definitely a team that can compete for the National League Central title, but there's definitely, it's just a little bit of a different vibe than it has been in past years. Maybe not quite as kinetic as it has been in past years. What have you seen down there? Is it different than other spring trainings? Is, you know, if this truly is Craig Counsell's last year, is there any hint of that as he has met with the media and talked to you guys about this team? Or is it just business as usual? I mean, how would you classify it?
Business as usual. Nothing has changed. Counsell's counsel. The players are the players. The drills are the drills. The games are the games. There's some different faces, but above and beyond that, I wouldn't say there's been anything out of the ordinary in this camp. Now, I would agree that, you know, from a fan's perspective, with the way things have kind of shaken out with the team over the last 6 months or so, well, since the Hader trade, really, you know, there is a malaise over the organization with everything that's been going on. The Hader trade, not making the playoffs. The perception that the team is cheap by not spending money in free agency in the offseason. You've got the Craig Counsell stuff. Is it going to come back or not? You've got the Corbin Burns arbitration thing, like you mentioned. Now you've got the talk about the stadium money.
Yeah.
It's a lot. It's a lot. And the narrative has been decidedly negative, I would say. So maybe this year more than any other, the Brewers need some guys to kind of develop quickly in camp. Thinking back, like a Chris Davis camp from 2014 or 15 or whatever that was, 14, I think, or 13 even, maybe that far back, bunch of home runs. Jesus Aguilar, bunch of home runs. You know, some good storylines going into the season and then getting off to a hot start. It's not going to be easy. The Brewers open Chicago against the Cubs, and they have a really long road trip the third week of the season out west. So it's not going to be easy by any means, but this is a team that really is in need of some positive storylines moving forward. And I do agree that they are positioned with their pitching And despite what people say, I think it's a pretty balanced lineup. They addressed most of their pieces in the offseason. They added starting pitching depth. They added William Contreras. So they've got players, no question about it. But to turn this narrative, they're going to need to win a bunch of games early, I think, and get people excited and get people off the offseason, all these negative things, and turn their attention to, hey, actually, this is kind of a good team, and maybe this could be another fun season.
Indeed. All right, Todd, any last thoughts before I let you go?
Last thoughts. I would say that the weather here has been very disappointing in my eyes. I know everybody back home is dealing with snow and cold and rain, but when I go home next Monday, there's a very, very good chance I will not have enjoyed even one 80-degree day down here. It's been winter jackets and pants and fleeces and all kinds of stuff. So it's been a very strange spring from that perspective, because usually this is right around the time when the weather starts to warm up a little bit, and usually by the end of camp it starts getting pretty toasty. But that will be Kurt Hoag's problem, and I will be home freezing with everybody else.
At Wrigley Field, wearing the same layers that you're wearing right now in Phoenix.
Yeah, and along with you, from what I understand.
That's right, baby.
So we'll be double teaming it.
That's right. We will be there for that home opener, or I should say season opener. That's, of course, at Wrigley Field on March 31st. But big time in Milwaukee sports. You've got the Panthers. You've got the Brewers. The Milwaukee Bucks are on a 14-game winning streak as we record this. So lots of reasons to get a Journal Sentinel subscription, jsonline.com/deal, where you can check out the latest deals. And get one of those digital subscriptions so you can follow along, especially if you're a Brewers fan. Obviously, the season getting going means we will have a lot of coverage at jsonline.com. Todd Rosiak's stories in abundance from Arizona are there as we speak. Todd, thank you for joining us, man. We'll chat with you again next week.
Always a pleasure.
Always a pleasure. We now move to a conversation with another colleague of mine. That would be Tom Dakin, business reporter with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He has written quite a bit lately about American Family Field, about the stadium and the financing of it. There is, of course, as many people know by now, a proposal by Governor Tony Evers to earmark some money, some money from the state government to the Milwaukee Brewers organization for stadium upgrades, stadium upkeep, and in return, the Brewers would be asked to extend their lease for all the way through the year 2043. The deal isn't official yet. There's still some steps it has to go through. It has to get all the support it needs, but it at least sounds somewhat likely that it's going to happen. And I wanted to ask Tom some of the basics. I know this can be really confusing, the stadium financing and how it works, and which parts of the stadium that the stadium district, by extension, the taxpayers of Wisconsin already pay for, which parts they would now be paying for, and kind of how it all works. It's a little bit confusing. I know that when the stadium tax hit its sunset a couple years ago, I think a lot of people understandably assumed that they were done paying for American Family Field. That's not entirely true. So brought him in to get some thoughts on exactly how this all works, and hopefully this is instructive. And if you are only interested in the on-field product, we'll be back with you again next week. See you soon. My guest is Milwaukee Journal Sentinel business reporter Tom Dakin. He has written a lot about the stadium public financing and the stadium in general at American Family Field in Milwaukee. There's been a lot of news over the course of this offseason. I've written a little bit about it as well, but I wanted to get Tom in here to explain some of these details, some of these fine points, a lot of things that I think, you know, people understand that there is public money for stadiums, but maybe not some of the nuances. So Tom, I'm going to start with kind of the simple question. I don't know how many people even understand the stadium district concept and like what it means. It's a government organization, which I think might catch people by surprise. So can you just to set it for us, how does the stadium district work? What is it? And like, what does that relate to the common man at all? Like what do I say about the stadium district?
Right. Well, this dates back to the late 90s when the state legislature at the time passed the bill to create the stadium sales tax that was used to help finance what was then Miller Park. This happened under Governor Tommy Thompson's administration. And the legislation included creating the Southeast Professional Baseball Park District. That's the public agency that owns the ballpark and leases it to the Brewers. And that district is run by a board whose members, I believe, are appointed by the governor, the mayor, and the Milwaukee County executive.
So there's three people total?
Well, more than three people. Three people who do the appointing, but the board itself, I believe they have, I think, nine members. The person who is currently board president is Tim Sheehy, a name that might be familiar to some of your listeners. Tim is the longtime CEO of the Milwaukee Metropolitan Association of Commerce, which is the Milwaukee area's largest business group.
Sure. Okay. And so this organization primarily deals with issues regarding the lease. The lease agreement with the Milwaukee Brewers is with this organization. Is that correct?
That is correct, yes.
Okay. And part of that lease indicates that taxpayers are actually already on the hook. We've been talking the last couple of weeks about some of the money that Governor Tony Evers is willing to set aside for upgrades to American Family Field in return for the Brewers extending their lease through the year 2043. But taxpayers actually are already on the hook for some things, even though the stadium sales tax reached its sunset a couple years ago. So how does that work? What are some of the things that the taxpayers actually already were on the hook to pay for?
Right. Well, the lease is structured to require the Brewers to be responsible for what's categorized as routine maintenance. Think about things you do at the end of a game and you have to sweep up all the peanut shells and mop up all the spilled beer and all that stuff. Things like that. Capital improvements, which are the actual renovations you do to the ballpark. Let's say the retractable roof, part of it breaks down and needs a part replaced. That falls under the responsibility of the stadium district, i.e. the taxpayers under that lease. Hmm. Now, the 0.5% sales tax, 0.5% sales tax that existed in the five counties in southeastern Wisconsin up until 3 years ago, in addition to paying down the debt that was amassed by the taxpayers to help pay for the baseball stadium, it also set aside about $70 million for future maintenance needs. What the Brewers are saying essentially is, we're going to need more money than that to pay for the obligations going forward, which at least go until 2030. That's when the lease is currently scheduled to end. As you pointed out, under this current deal, the state would provide another $290 million under Governor Evers' budget proposal, if approved by the legislature. And in return, the Brewers would extend their lease from 2030 to the end of 2043.
Okay, so if the taxpayers are already on the hook for things like roof upgrades, let's say. Let's say a piece of the roof falls off. That does fall to the taxpayers. This money then would be in addition to that. This money, in theory, it would be upgrades as in like making the stadium closer to the modern stadium. Is that right or oversimplifying?
That's correct. I mean, there are a lot of things that are on the list of what the Brewers project are going to be needed. This is based on a consultant that they hired and then was vetted by the state through its own study. A lot of it is stuff that you would expect to see in a large building that's heavily used, that's 20 years and plus old.
And the most voluminous building in the state of Wisconsin,
right,
for that matter.
I mean, elevators, escalators, heating ventilation equipment, plumbing fixtures, you name it. All that stuff wears down, needs to be replaced, needs to be upgraded. But some of, to me, the more interesting changes that are anticipated by the Brewers consultant is what you just alluded to, the kinds of things that the lease, again, obligates the stadium district to pay for to, quote unquote, keep up with the Joneses. There's a clause that basically says you've got to keep that stadium up to par with other MLB ballparks as new ones are built, as old ones are renovated. It kind of raises the bar for ballparks, and through that lease, the public is obligated to make those payments. They fall under the general category of quote-unquote capital improvements.
So that's interesting. And you wrote about this at jsonline.com, really kind of clarifying what percentage of ballparks must have a feature before American Family Field or Miller Park, however you want to think of it, before that ballpark must not necessarily be obligated to it, but if they then want to add that feature themselves – because enough ballparks have it,
right,
that is something that people are already obligated to pay for under the conditions of the lease,
right.
Which is super interesting. So what's the new money for? Is it to even better keep up with the Joneses? Is it like, we're going to not just keep up with them, we're going to become, again, the standard for baseball stadiums around Major League Baseball? Or how does this work?
Well, again, the money that the Evers administration is proposing and that the Brewers say is needed is, again, money that both of those parties say are needed to help the stadium district meet its obligations under the lease. And let's not mince any words here. A lease is a legal contract.
Sure.
And entities can be sued when they breach legal contracts, okay? So there is this obligation there, again, at least through 2030, possibly extended to 2043 under this arrangement. And all that money goes to the various capital improvements, including the things we've just talked about. Mm-hmm. And I will have a story coming out on Friday of this week, I believe, that talks a little bit more about the kinds of things fans might be able to expect to see if this all gets approved by the legislature and the Brewers do pursue some of the things that you see happening in other stadiums and some things that have been happening at American Family Field in recent years as well, but just kind of writ large on a grander scale.
And some of those things, just as a teaser, you were talking to me off mic a little about some of the gathering places. Mm-hmm. I don't know if any of this stuff will come as a shock necessarily, but it is interesting stuff. What are a couple of those things that you've noticed?
Well, certainly at American Family Field, if you think in terms of like the various quote-unquote party decks that have been added since the park opened, more recently we've had a golf simulation facility that opened last September.
Much-discussed X-Golf. Yes,
X-Golf. And now you've written, I think, a little bit about this. Coming in April at the home opener, we're going to have a renovated restaurant. Mm-hmm. Now, I should hasten to add, both of those facilities were paid for by the Brewers. Those did not fall under a category of required by the lease. But other sort of gathering spaces could end up being required by the lease by virtue of the clause we were discussing earlier, the kind of keeping up with the Joneses clause. And some of the things I think you could expect to see based on what we see at other ballparks are perhaps some fixed seats being removed and creating more space where people pay basically for an SRO ticket. You go there and you watch the game, you hang out at a bar, and you don't really have a seat assigned per se. That's been done in other ball clubs to great success. One of the examples I cite in my story that's coming out Friday is Progressive Field, where Cleveland Guardians, and they added a few of these places. Fans really like them, so now Cleveland is going to start doing a major renovation project at the end of this coming season. And among the things they're going to be doing are more of those kinds of features, and a lot of this is really aimed at the younger generation of fans, people who aren't the kind of people who go and sit there in a seat, watch every pitch, score along. These are people who are going, and sometimes they're watching the games, and sometimes they're not watching the game. They might just like to be in a bar area, yucking it up with their friends, and every once in a while they hear the crack of a bat and the roar of the crowd, and they'll say, oh, look up at the video board. There's a home run being hit, hopefully by Christian Yelich. And that's the kind of stuff MLB is doing more of, because MLB needs to get more people coming to their ballparks, particularly younger people.
This isn't something that has necessarily full-throated bipartisan support, but I know the Republicans have sort of tepidly said, sounds like a decent idea. We'll look into it and get back to you. To me, that counts as just about the closest thing you get to bipartisan mm-hmm. support. So I'm guessing, even though we're talking about this as a proposal at this point, this is going to pass, right? Is that your estimation as well?
Oh, gosh. I wouldn't hazard a guess, to be honest.
Got it.
But I do agree with you. It was interesting to see both Assembly Speaker Voss and the Senate Majority Leader, Devin Lemieux, both say things that essentially said, we'll consider it.
Yes.
And quite honestly, that reaction from the two most powerful Republicans in the state legislature to a proposal from a Democratic governor, Tony Evers, that's not usually the way it goes.
No.
Usually it's the statements are along the lines of, well, we're going to rewrite this or this ain't never going to happen. So for those two to basically say what they said, I think that indicates that, yeah, there'll at least be support from the leadership. Now, the question is, can they still get their members to vote for it? They still have to go to the hard work of persuading individual Republican legislators from places that are far, far from Milwaukee to vote for this based on the arguments being made in favor of it, because there are plenty of arguments being made in opposed to it by the opponents.
I wrote a little bit about this at jsonline.com as well. I'm talking to a couple economists outside the state of Wisconsin, mm-hmm. looking at they have some frustration with the sort of economic impact surveys that are done in communities, both to support the building of a perhaps pro sports stadium, or even just paying to upgrade it, putting public money towards sports stadiums. There are a lot of people who will tell you that's a scam, and there are a lot of organizations that will come in and say, no, look, there is a significant economic impact. How do you look at those? If one of those comes across your desk, and they have, they did something very similar for Pfizer Forum before that was built, and for this stadium, of course. How big of a grain of salt are we talking? What are some of the valuable things you can take from those things?
Well, I think some of the economic benefits are fairly easy to actually estimate and quantify. So from the perspective of state taxpayers, the argument could be made that, look, the Brewers are like any other business. If you keep them in Wisconsin, they generate state income tax based on the number of people they employ. They generate a certain amount of state sales tax based on items being sold at the stadium, et cetera. And you can look at how much they generate now, and you can sort of extrapolate out in the future what those benefits will continue to be. I think where things get a little trickier are when we try and measure the economic impact of people spending money in relation to a Brewers game. Sure. So, of course, naturally, you'll get those studies that will say, oh, we estimate X amount of money is spent over the course of a year at a Brewers game, and we estimate X amount goes to, you know, bars and restaurants on Blue Mountain Road or hotels for people coming to overnight stays. I think those studies are more difficult to quantify, and I think those studies often conveniently ignore the fact that the money that fans spend is discretionary income. It's not like making your mortgage or rent payment or buying groceries, stuff that you need. These are items that, if the Brewers didn't exist, that money would likely still be spent on other things, presumably mostly other sports and leisure type activities. So that's one thing. The other thing is, when you're measuring how much money a public entity, in this case the state government, should invest in something, in this case a ballpark, the question you should also be asking is, okay, $290 million, is there another place we could be spending that $290 million where it would have an even bigger impact?
Right.
If you're a Republican, you're probably going to say, yeah, we're going to cut taxes. That's our philosophy. If you are a Democrat, you might say, well, that $290 million would be better spent on, let's say, mass transit, for example.
For sure.
Those are the kinds of questions that I think elected officials who have to make these decisions should be asking.
One last thought, and by the way, sort of a supplement to that, there is also an emotional component that The Economist spoke to, where
sure,
people who do love the Milwaukee Brewers or would be afraid of the team leaving town if they weren't able to finance or get the financing they wanted for certain aspects. And, you know, that's sort of an intangible thing, but it is these surveys are not, like you said, taking into account what would the alternative be, because their job is to say what it is, not what it could be, you know,
right,
what this particular thing is. The last thing is the years on the lease that are being asked for here till 2043. Mm-hmm. So an additional 13 years. That's an unusual number. Do you have any sense on where they came up with that number? Why 13 and not something more round or something? I don't know. Like, it strikes me as an interesting number.
I think it was based on projecting out the amount that is estimated that would need to be spent for all these various capital improvements that we discussed at the top of this podcast. Mm-hmm. That totals well over $400 million, including when you factor in your projected rate of inflation. And they were projecting out roughly 20 years.
Okay.
So you go from 2023 to 2043. I think that's the basis for extending the lease to that particular end date.
Sure. Got it. All right. This has been illuminating. Anything else that you want to throw in here that we should know about these stadium leases?
I don't know if we can do anything for Christian Yelich's launch angle, but we can only hope, fingers crossed, Brewers fans.
This is true. Awesome. Tom Dakin, business reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Again, he's got a story coming Friday that has even more on where some of this money is going into the stadium, some of the changes, you know, and the long-term changes you might see at American Family Field. I think people will find that interesting. Thank you, Tom.
Thank
Hopefully
you,
we'll do
Joe.
This again.
You bet.